Good evening and welcome to tonight's panel discussion on what's next for international climate action. Welcome also to our 10-year celebration, the celebration of the 10th anniversary of the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment. My name is Sam Frankhauser, I'm director of the Grantham Research Institute. I'm also in my fourth day as director of the ESRC Center for Climate Change Economics and Policy, CSEP, which is housed by Grantham and Grant jointly with the University of Leeds. 4 days ago, that job belonged to Simon Deeds, who may or may not be in the audience here.
Yes, he is.
Sabbatical, and therefore going to lectures is probably not, no longer within his scope. He is there and looking unduly relaxed. So 10 years, an anniversary of 10 years is an opportunity to both look back what we've achieved, what we've done, but also to look forward to see what we want to do over the next 5 years or indeed the next 10 years. And we're mostly looking forward tonight. We have a panel of people who are very forward looking. But we want to do a little bit of the backward bit as well. And with that in mind, you have on your seats two publications. One of them is backward looking. It sort of looks at what we've done over the first 10 years of our existence. And I think we've achieved a fair amount of things. When you sort of see it all together, you sort of feel good about it and you start to understand why you've been busy. So that's one booklet that you have in front of you, and I immediately stop and correct myself. It isn't a booklet, it's a commemorative brochure. So the booklet contains the backward look of what we've done. You also have a couple of pages on our ambition of what we want to do over the next 5 years. Because we feel we've only just started, we've achieved a lot of things, but the problems we are dealing with, the problems we are interested in, of sustainability, of climate change, there's a lot that still has to be done, and we sort of feel our analysis, our engagement is still needed. So have a good look at those two publications, ideally not while the panel is speaking, maybe you look at them on the train home. So in terms of those introductory remarks, that only leaves me to do two things. One is the usual housekeeping. Please put your phones on mute. Don't switch them off because you may want to tweet. If you are tweeting, rumor has it there's a hashtag, if there is one, indeed, Grantham LSE10. If you want to tweet about that, that is the hashtag you want to use. The plan of the night is that we will have a panel discussion, and I will introduce the panel in a second, for about 40 minutes or so, and then around about 7:30, we open it up to questions and answers from the audience, from you, and just before 8 o'clock or so, we're hoping to wrap up. So that's the plan. The other thing I want to do before I introduce the panel is introduce Eric Neumeier. Eric is pro-director for faculty development here at LSE, and we have him here because we are part of LSE, and I have to say, being a part of LSE is a great experience. If you want to be a research centre, there's no better place to be one than LSE. It's a really creative, supportive, clever, intellectual, good place to be a research centre. So we're grateful to the LSE for hosting us. We are grateful to Eric, in particular, who is an associate of Grantham because he's an environmental economist by background, and in fact has contributed to Grantham right from the beginning. Eric and I go back. I think we were PhD students roughly the same time. He was at LSE. I was at UCL. At that time, that meant Eric was a bit lonely and had nobody to talk to, and he would come up to UCL to talk to us. So just to show you how things have changed. Eric, over to you.
Thank you.
Yes, so
an official welcome from the LSE as well. In fact, from our director, Minouche Schaffing. Now, obviously, I'm not Minouche. She's in New York, but she sends her best regards and a warm welcome. As Sam mentioned, I have personal links to Grantham. I saw the Institute grow. In fact, I have to say that on Monday morning, when we have always a catch-up of the school management committee, and I said, you know, everyone goes around a little bit and says, what are we doing? I said, on Thursday, I'm there for the Grantham event. I think it's 15 years. Of course, it's only 10, but it almost feels like 15 years, given what the Institute has achieved and the enormous amount of activity, the buzz that the place has. It could be 15 years, is what I'm saying. I was personally involved in one project with Munich Re. A small anecdote there. Munich Re sort of expected a certain result, and I had to sort of convey to them that's not exactly how research works, but we got around in the end. Now, you have your brochure on the external impact there. If I can just mention a few highlights. The Paris Agreement, where Nick, he's here, was extremely influential and very active behind the scenes. The impact on UK climate policy through the Committee on Climate Change and interactions at all sorts of level, and of course a strong footprint, particularly on the environmental economics profession, but of course not only. Where does Grantham feature internally? That's not so much in your brochure, but it is one of LSE's biggest research centers. Don't have the exact figures, but it could be the second biggest ones. 50 core staff, well over 100 if you count associate students and visitors. And what I really like about it, it's truly interdisciplinary. Yes, geography and environment is perhaps its closest affiliation, but it has links to IR, to economics, to stats, international development law, and others. And the Grantham and Grantham staff, the Institute and its staff, truly are visible across the school. Many teach, others give research seminars. There's the exec summer school course, active participants in governance across the school. So it is, from the institution's viewpoint, a real success story. And we from SMC wish Grantham another 10 or 15 years, I'm not quite sure what it is. I'm handing over back to you, Sam. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Eric. 15 is fine, but we will focus on the next 5, say. Let me introduce you to our panelists, and I'm pleased to have a full set of panelists. I'll explain you, well, I'll be pleased anyway, but I'll explain you why I'm particularly pleased. And I'm starting the far left for me. We have Emma Howard-Boyd, who came here by train, which is why we weren't quite sure when she would come. And that's why we're very pleased, Emma, that you made it.
So am I.
Emma is the chair of the Environment Agency here in the UK. And through that, actually, you're one of our patrons and sponsors, because we work with the Environment Agency in one of our initiatives, the Transition Pathways Initiative, which works with institutional investors about the carbon footprint, the carbon behavior of their investee companies. If you're looking at the booklet that you have in front of you, you can see Emma on page 7, just as proof that indeed she is one of us. And Emma's background actually indeed is in sustainable finance. That's what she has been doing through her career, starting with Jupiter Asset Management, but also through a series of non-executive directorships and advisorships. So very pleased, Emma, to have you here just in time. We then have Nick Stern, a man who doesn't need too much of an introduction. Nick is, amongst many other things, he is the chairman of the Grantham Research Institute. He's also the chairman of CSEP, so of our ESRC Centre. Many of you will remember Nick as the brains and the name behind the Stern Review on the Economics of Climate Change. It's about 12 years ago now that it was launched, And that was, in many senses, a precursor or led to the Granton Research Institute and to CSEP. Nick has done many other things as well, too many to mention here. I first met Nick, I'm pretty sure you don't remember that, in 1999 when I joined EBRD. Nick was the chief economist at EBRD at the time. The pleasure didn't last very long because Nick announced his resignation in my first staff meeting. He went on to be chief economist of the World Bank and then second permanent secretary to the Treasury, where he wrote the Stern Review and then came back to LSE. We then have Judith Rees. Judith is many things as well, but she's the vice chair of the Granton Research Institute. And for me, she is, actually not just for me, for many people here at the school, she's the person you go to when you're in trouble. She is really helpful, insightful, the sort of vice chair that you want to have in your institution. And because that is well known, she has had very many other functions and responsibilities as well, one of which was to be the acting director of the school when the school was in trouble. As I said, you call for Judith when you were in trouble. And Judith was a very good chair, sorry, a very good director of LSE. She's also been the chair of the Royal Geographical Society. She's been at LSE for longer than you probably want to admit, but I'm saying it anyway, 1962. And no, I wasn't born then either.
Thank you, sir.
Really, it is great.
But that's the reason why we put somebody here. Let me introduce our final panelist, Adair Turner. Adair Turner is currently the chair of the Energy Transition Commission. But before that, again, he's had very many functions. One of them was the first chair of the UK Committee on Climate Change, and that's when I came across Adair. Another thing you don't know, you rang me up very politely, kindly, personally to tell me that I would be a member of the committee. You did that at 9 in the morning. What you didn't know was that I was in the US and it was 4 in the morning. But the phone call was appreciated. So that's our panel. Let's get started, and maybe Adair, I start with you. Sustainable development, a huge challenge. Decarbonization is part of that huge challenge. You've given a lot of thought of just technologically, in terms of behavior, technology, how one might do that. Do you want to sort of explain why net zero by the middle of the century, which is what the Paris Agreement wants us to do, why this is not altogether mad?
Well, I think it's not altogether mad at all. I think it's completely doable. And the Energy Transitions Commission, just so I can explain it, is a coalition of companies and NGOs. It has some combination of membership that you wouldn't necessarily expect to be together. It has BP and Shell, and it has Rocky Mountain Institute and World Resources Institute. It has Tata Steel, it has Chinese renewable energy companies, etc. And we're trying to work out what is the path to net zero by mid-century. And the good news is, and we'll be setting this out in a report in November, that we believe it is absolutely possible at costs as low to the economy as Nick Stern suggested, and indeed lower than Nick suggested 10 years ago. How is it possible? One of the crucial things that, of course, has occurred over the last 10 years is the dramatic fall in the price of renewable electricity. When Sam and I were back working together at the Climate Change Committee in 2008, we, of course, knew that the cost of wind and solar was going to come down, and we produced reports setting out how fast we thought it would come down. I have to say, I hope people have destroyed those reports because they will be so embarrassing how wrong we got it. We completely failed to realise that solar would come down by 80 or 90%, that wind could come down by 60 or 70%, that battery costs would be down by 80%. And in our first report of the Energy Transition Commission last year, we focused on electricity and we said it is now possible to imagine building systems, electricity systems, which are near total, 85 or 90%, based on intermittent renewables, and that you can do that and provide 24/7 electricity at a cost which is competitive with fossil fuels, and which in the most favourable parts of the world will be considerably cheaper than fossil fuels. So we now have the real possibility that we can decarbonise electricity and then electrify as much of the economy as possible. But what we then noted last year is that you then have to ask the question, well, what are you going to do about the really hard to abate sectors of the economy where it's just not so straightforward to electrify them? Things like steel, cement, chemicals, plastics, ammonia, and long distance trucking and shipping and aviation. How do we decarbonise those? And that's the report that we will be producing on November the 20th this year, simultaneously in China, India, Europe and the US. And our analysis says that those sectors also can achieve net zero in themselves and without buying offsets from other sectors of the economy or from the land use sectors of the economy. Now, how is that possible? It's essentially possible because you have sort of four technologies. First of all, some of it can be directly electrified with batteries. And we think that, for instance, beyond autos and beyond urban buses, there is probably going to be a more rapid battery electrification of trucking than most people have realised. Or you can use, and that the electricity can also be used to electrify bits of intense heat, and there are bits of shipping and aviation which will electrify as well. Or you can use hydrogen. You can use hydrogen to reduce steel as an alternative reduction agent to a coking coal. We can use hydrogen in various chemical processes. We can use hydrogen as a heat source. Or we can use biomass. With biomass, we have to be aware of the limits to sustainable biomass, but it is available as a technology, and in some areas, it will be required. We don't think we're anywhere near getting a plane to go across the Atlantic with either batteries or hydrogen. That's where we're going to continue to need a liquid hydrocarbon made from biofuel or synthetic sources. And finally, we think you can do carbon capture and either storage or use. We're not willing to plug into our models the huge amounts of late 21st century carbon capture and storage which some models assume, but we think it will be required in some sectors of the economy. It's quite difficult to work out how you will decarbonise cement without carbon capture and then doing something with the CO2, because the very chemical process of making cement produces CO2, even if you have completely decarbonised the heat input. So we've got a range of technologies, and what our analysis suggests is that if you look at that range of technologies, there is a way to decarbonise all of the sectors, and I'm happy to answer questions later about what they particular are, but across these most difficult sectors of the economy, we can do it, and we can do it at a low enough cost that it's affordable for the economy, but not as a zero cost. Let me be clear, I think international flight will probably have to cost 10 or 15% more, because I see almost no scenario in which biofuels are actually going to get cheaper than conventional jet fuel, even though the price premium may reduce. Interestingly, probably the biggest economic cost, this was news to me, but 70% of the industrial decarbonisation cost is in one sector, cement. That's the most difficult sector of the economy to decarbonise. But across them all, we're convinced that the technological possibility at a low cost is there. So am I therefore confident that we will get to net zero by 2050 or 60? Well, I'm confident that we can do it, that it's technologically possible. I'm absolutely confident that if I was the benevolent dictator of the entire world, I could, with an appropriate set of carbon prices and regulation, get there at a low cost. But I'm not confident, or not confident enough, that we have a political process that will get us there. So I think our biggest challenge is how do we get the policies to unleash what is completely technologically and economically possible. That is really our biggest challenge, rather than the technologies themselves, because the technologies are available even if you don't assume what we know will occur, which is that sometime over the next 10 or 20 years, we will achieve technological breakthroughs that we haven't even thought of. And those will be endogenously stimulated by the very fact of committing to a zero carbon economy. We haven't put those into our figures. We've assumed only the technologies that we already know are there and can be developed. So my overall story, Sam, is an optimistic point of view about what is technologically and economically possible, and a big political challenge globally and a global coordination challenge to make sure that we actually have the policies which get us to where we could be.
Okay, very good. Let me turn to Nick, maybe, who told me beforehand that he doesn't want to be called an optimist. So I'll just call you confident. And you, the technological story that Adair tells, you would complement that with a story of growth, broadening it to sustainability. Is that a way of overcoming the politics? If this is good for growth and prosperity, is that enough to make it happen?
It's a necessary condition for it to happen, is that we recognise that if we do this well, we can be much better off, not only in terms of conventional measures, but actually much more deeply in terms of the quality of life and how we live. I came into all this as somebody who spent their life, professional life, working on growth and development, and that has sustained my interest in climate right through the last 10 or 15 years. But of course, looking inside it is always incredibly fascinating, as Adair has just indicated. But it's the growth and development story that I want to focus on here, and the sustainable growth and development story. We have to start with the urgency. Essentially, the world's infrastructure will double in about 15 years. The world economy will double in around 20 years. It doesn't matter whether it's 18 or 25 for this argument. That's just a growth rate for the world economy, around 3.1 or so, which is what is reasonable to suppose. The world's city population will double in 30 or 40 years, and its land acreage and cities much sooner than that. So you can see the next 20 years is absolutely decisive, because that's a period when we have to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by, depending on how you do it, but by 25-30% or more. Absolutely, not per unit of output, absolutely. So here is the world economy doubling, infrastructure doubling in 20, infrastructure doubling in 15, and you've got to reduce emissions by 25-30%. That's enough to show in a crystal clear way that you have to do things radically different. If that new economy looks anything like the old, side by side with the one that came before, there's no way you're going to cut by 30%. Indeed, you'll probably add by 60 or 70%. And the chance of 2 degrees, probably the chance of 3 degrees, could be gone in 20 years of mismanagement, because you lock in the infrastructure, you lock in the capital equipment that's dirty and polluting. So there's an intense urgency. And if you get a bit relaxed and say, well, you know, maybe you get up to 3 degrees, wouldn't be so bad, would it? Think again. We haven't been at 3 degrees for 3 million or so years. We're seeing extremes at 1 degree centigrade now, which is already at the limit of the human civilization that's developed since the last ice age. 3 degrees, which what we're heading for, roughly speaking, if we don't ramp up the Paris commitments, could be way gone in 20 years. And the urgency is intense. So it's very good that we know we can do it, but we have to move and act quickly. The second is the extraordinary momentum. And I won't labour the point, because Adair expressed it very well. But who would have thought 12 years ago the heads of all the major car companies will be talking about the end of the era of the internal combustion engine? Who would have thought a dozen years or so ago that we can see how we can do with far less cars because we can be much better at sharing them? Who would have said a dozen or so years ago that we could run our cities with autonomous vehicles very close to each other, interacting with each other, that the borderlines between public and private transport would start to disappear. And wherever you look, the electricity there was very clear on. Transport, it's been extraordinary. City design, we understand much better. We understand much better now that we can have cities where we can move and breathe, and I've understood it still more intensively, that that's a good idea, even if we've never heard of climate change. So the momentum has been quite extraordinary in terms of technology and in terms of understanding, in terms of legislation. We took the report for the Commission for Africa to the G8 summit in 2005, which I was writing before the climate change report. And the second subject at the G8 summit in Gleneagles in Scotland was climate change. And I was there looking at these people, men, their eyes just sort of glazed over when the subject of climate change. They were quite good on Africa, actually. They'd thought about it, they'd focused on it. But their Sherpas asked us, why are you bothering us with this marginal subject? This isn't fit for presidential consideration. If you look now how the technology has changed, how the centrality of this argument to political discussion has changed, we've come an awfully long way. Still bordering on what you might call optimistic, I'm cautious about the term, if you look now at the growth story, when we did the Stern Review, we said the costs of inaction are far bigger than the costs of action. That is much more deeply, powerfully true now than it was then, given what we understand. But it's more than that. I think what we now recognise that this is the sustainable growth story of the 21st century, that the kinds of discoveries, the economies of scale in learning and discovery are immense, and we haven't fully understood yet just how strong those can be. So we need a different understanding of the process of growth, and that actually will be the centre of my own research in the next couple of years. When I was very young, my PhD thesis was on mathematical growth theory, and in my old age I'm coming back to that, because we have to do our growth theory differently. It's not about long-run steady states anymore. It is about how fast we can move and how quickly we can learn and how quickly we can change technique over this next 10, 20, 30 years. And that, I think, is something which we at the LSE must work on, and it is the growth story of the 21st century. We've just published the new climate economy report in September, which is exactly that, and it's called Unlocking the Inclusive Growth Story of the 21st Century. So it's still stronger now than you've got to pay a little bit here, you've got to pay a little bit there. It's actually a different pattern of growth, with ecosystems which are robust and fruitful, cities where you can move and breathe, and costs and ways of doing things being driven down constantly. So what we can do is enormously attractive, and we can do it in time. But I'm going to end exactly where Adair ended, wondering whether we can move quickly enough. But the first thing is to show it and argue it and demonstrate it and assemble the evidence. That's a necessary condition. You can't ask people to go off in a certain direction if you haven't got a clue what it looks like or why you're doing it. Now, we do have a clue what it looks like. We know we're going to learn like mad along the way, and we know intensely why we're doing it, and we can see how to do it. So that's the first part, as it were, of the challenge of really driving political action. It's not the whole story, and we'll talk more, I'm sure, during this evening.
Very good. Let's turn to maybe Judith first, as somebody who is always sort of injecting a dose of realism in most things that that we're debating. Do you buy the story you just heard?
Not entirely. My heart buys it, but my head often doesn't. And I mean, I think one of the troubles with the sustainable growth sort of mantra is that people just forget that there are going to have to be some really hard choices, and there are a series of trade-offs that we're going to have to make. I don't believe we can have everything. If you look at the Sustainable Development Goals, I mean, they are incredibly worthy, right? But look at them carefully, and look at what that would imply. You know, quite major, massive changes. Where I start from is thinking of by 2050, we're going to have something like 9.7 billion people on Earth. There's 7.3 now. Even on optimistic assumptions, that means that about a 50% increase in the amount of food demand that there's going to be. Now, where is this going to come from? What changes are going to have to occur? People talk all the time about sustainable intensification of agriculture. But if you have a look at some of the latest figures, you find that investment in agriculture in the less developed countries is actually going down in real terms. And you'll also find some evidence that climate change effects, drought, temperature, and so on, are actually reducing yields in some areas. So, you know, there's really quite an issue there. And the intensification process involves an enormous amount of investment. And some of the investment is going to be in the water sector. It's going to have to be in the water sector. And that's something I've dabbled in for really rather a long time. And I really am concerned that the lack of investment, the lack of innovation, the lack of institutional change in that sector across the world is going to create an enormous water security crisis. I mean, there's something like 40% of the world's population already living in water-stressed areas. So to me, that is a sort of critical issue. If we don't intensify, then what are we going to do? Look for other land? If we look for deforestation, if we go around the deforestation, that is against one thing, I forget which goal. Oh, it's 15, isn't it? SDG 15. And of course, the effect on the environment, ecosystems, biodiversity will be huge. So what I'm saying is that I find it very, very difficult for us to think about meeting all the SDGs and to not be honest with people that we're going to have to make sets of really quite hard choices. Where I do agree, there has to be an enormous amount of political change. There has to be an enormous amount of behavioural change at the customer level, at the business level, and also at the government level. I mean, there are an awful lot of consumers who say, yes, they would buy into the environment. You know, it's a good thing, protect climate change, protect the ecosystems. But when they have to give up something, then the story tends to become rather different. And I think that's, in a sense, slightly epitomized by the, America First type rhetoric that is going on at the moment. So I think there are huge challenges, and I think trying to do that by 2030 or 2050 is going to take skills that we actually don't have of persuading people and governments that change is actually needed.
I see, but Nick Turner seems to go, but let me turn to Emma. We've heard a few times now that a certain amount of climate change is in the pipeline, and so adaptation to the risks that we already have has to be part of the story. In Judith's view, this is sort of something that could jeopardize the beautiful of there in Nick's story. This is sort of your area, that's your responsibility in the UK. How well prepared is the UK, is the world, how well prepared can we be for the bits of climate change that we will have?
So I've come today from a visit to Cumbria, where back in 2015-16 we saw significant rainfall events. But the day was focused not just on the too much water, but also this question of too little water. And I suppose if I look at my career in the investment sector, I would suggest that we put a lot of our attention on the low carbon transition and probably not focused enough on the whole resilience agenda and making sure that as we are investing in all of this infrastructure that is so much needed to facilitate the transition to a low carbon economy, that we're also making sure that it is resilient to the physical risks of climate change. Because what is the point of investing in energy efficiency if it washes away in a flood, or indeed, as we saw this summer, potentially could melt away in a heat wave? But again, I think that is a huge opportunity for us to really reframe the way we're thinking about these issues. And I'm aware that businesses are beginning to put figures on how much they need to invest in making sure that their facilities are resilient to a changing climate. So an example I've given would be the business of Bloomberg, where following Hurricane Sandy and what happened to their servers in the basement, they have now put an additional capital expenditure of 10% to make sure that their key facilities are resilient to the physical risks of climate change. So I think that is, from a business community perspective, from an investment perspective, something that is absolutely going up the agenda. But we need to make sure that as we're having those conversations, we are mindful of what is already happening, not just in our country, but globally. Because what we've seen in our country over the last year, over the last 5 years, still pales into insignificance in relation to some of the very, very significant events that we've seen elsewhere around the world. But I think we have to maintain this, this sense of urgency and sense of, I suppose, a direction that we have everything to gain if we focus on these important questions. And that's, where those of us who are leading organisations, and I see in the audience a number of familiar faces, need to be resolved to focus our attention. And the students in the audience, you're going to be working on this issue for the rest of your careers, and we need the best brains really focused on making sure that we are delivering on a sustainable economy.
Nick, does what Emma just said sort of change your optimism, if I allow to use that word, about sustainable prosperity? Is the impacts that we already have in the pipeline, as it were, on climate change, is that going to jeopardise development or not?
Yeah. It's very important that we put reducing emissions, advancing living standards along the full dimensions of living standards, and resilience or adaptation together. It's not a horse race between one and the other. We're not going to succeed unless we actually manage to deal with all three. If you don't push up living standards, you're going to lose the political support for this whole story. If you don't mitigate, you're going to create environments so hostile that development will take place. And if you're not resilient, you're going to suffer enormously in the meantime. Mm. But there are lots we can do. I mean, take the system of root, and I've lived and worked in developing countries and much of the time in agriculture through 50 years of professional life. I mean, if you look at the system of root intensification, particularly for rice, but other crops as well, you use less water and you plant at different depths and different gaps and transplant at different times, and you don't flood the paddy field. And what happens then is flooded paddy fields release methane, so you don't release the methane. You have you save on water, so that's saving the water costs, the energy costs, and so on. It's good for development, and it's essentially more robust to difficult climates. If you take a lot of building, good buildings now will need less heating. They'll run their own electricity. They'll be more resilient, and we learn a lot from past building structures, and we learn enormously from current materials and design. If you look at public transport, it's a classic example of development, mitigation, adaptation, all being wrapped up together. So it's vitally important that we push ahead on all these things. And Adair and I were being fiercely analytical, and we look at the technologies, we look at the numbers, and you can see that the story we're telling, if you dig deep down into it, is really possible. Now, that doesn't mean it happens, and we both ended with saying, this is radical change. How do you generate radical change? We're social scientists as well as economists. We work on that too. Now, economics is social science, but we recognize that there are others as well, and we've noticed. And the way in which you manage that politics is absolutely fundamental. And many of us have been in the middle of that. I mean, what was COP21 other than managing intense international politics? And there's things that you can do, and the way you behave, and the arguments you put, and the evidence you bring to the table, and the respect you bring for other people. So those political processes are absolutely fundamental. But you don't deserve to get a crack at them if you haven't got a serious, tough analytical story. And that I think we do have.
So, yes, there, you sort of, you stopped, I felt I stopped you halfway through your argument, and the second half was about the politics. So your thoughts on how one unlocks the politics and turns you into the benevolent dictator of the world?
Well, let me take two comments. First of all, a comment on what Judith said, because I very much agreed with what you said, because actually I'm much less confident that we can deal with some other problems other than reducing emissions. I do believe that actually reducing emissions from the energy-using system may be something which we will solve while not solving some of the problems of water, of biodiversity. And whereas I think it's absolutely possible to build a zero-carbon economy by sometime soon after mid-century, if you would ask me how will we create sufficient jobs to provide good employment in rapidly growing African countries in a world where automation is destroying the need for factory workers, I'm really terrified that I don't know the answer to that. So my optimism is focused on the particular thing that I'm focused on rather than necessarily the totality of all the problems which we have to face. But if I was to return to the economics and what I think are some of the political difficulties of the economics, and they're to do with some trade-offs and some costs that I think we have to persuade people or businesses to take, and the fact that there are very different costs in different sectors of the economy. So I suspect, looking out here at the moment, I don't think it's going to be all that difficult to persuade this audience that we have to deal with climate change. I don't see many climate change deniers. I know how to spot them. But let's assume that this was just a random set of 100 citizens pulled off the street. I think, actually, if you said to them, is climate change important, they would either believe yes, or they would believe that, or you could persuade them that that was the case. I think if you said to them, look, you know, there will be economic growth, but it's possible that in 2050, your consumer expenditure may have to be 1% less in real terms in 2050 than it otherwise would. Are you willing to pay that cost to deal with climate change? I think we can probably persuade most people to do that. But if you said, are you willing to pay 25% more for international aviation, you might have hit a problem. But that might be the nature of where the cost is. I think it's probably the case that electrifying autos and trucks and buses is going to cost the economy nothing, that decarbonising electricity is going to cost us very little, that there are whole segments of the economy where the impact of decarbonisation, you know, is trivial either way. And then we'll have some very specific things like international aviation, where people will have to pay somewhat more. And they'll have to do it however much. They'll have to pay a bit more, however much, we achieve technological breakthrough. Because one of the conundrums here is that technology is probably going to drive down the price of fossil fuels as well as the price of biofuels. The future of a decarbonized world economy is going to be one in which oil is going to get very cheap because it's all going to be produced in the cheapest parts of the world. Ask yourself, in a world in which we have limitless solar power, how much will it cost to mine coal? Well, mining coal with robots, with limitless cheap solar power, is going to be very cheap indeed. So I suspect that we're going to have, in the long term, a race for the bottom in fossil fuel prices, and there will be some sectors of the economy where we will have to say, we could buy our energy cheaper than the way we want you to do it in a green fashion, but, you know, that's not what we want to do. So I still think we have to win these political arguments, and we also have to win the intermediate product conundrum and international competitiveness. What I mean by that is our calculation of how much it would cost to produce a ton of green steel, zero carbon steel, versus dirty steel, where you have about 1.8 tons of CO2 per ton of steel, is about $80 to $100 to go down the green steel route. Now, I think if you said to people, OK, well, you're about to buy a car which weighs about a ton, you're about to spend £15,000 on it, for the sake of the climate, are you willing to spend an extra $100, 60 quid, in order for it to be green? I think we can probably persuade people like that. But if you're up at the intermediate product level, and you're a steel company attempting to sell steel, and if you face a carbon price which is adding $60 a ton to your steel, and therefore CO2, and $100 to the ton of steel, you will be destroyed if other people aren't subject to that as well. So these things look very different at the intermediate business product level than at the end consumer product level. So how do we get around this? We have got to keep trying to create a political consensus that we've got to deal with this, even if there are some net costs in particular sectors. We have got to have some category of carbon pricing, though I think one of the crucial things here, which we will say in our report, is there's a tendency in carbon pricing to hold out that we're going to manage to get an all-singing, all-dancing, universal, all-sectors, all-countries carbon price, which is what economists like you and I dream about, because it will produce the lowest cost competitive market result.
Not all of us.
But we've got to realise that wouldn't be optimal in itself, but also if it's not possible, there's all sorts of things we can do on carbon pricing without doing that. We could impose carbon prices on the cement industry even without a generalised carbon price, because cement is not internationally traded while steel is. So there's all sorts of ways to get clever about carbon pricing, which we need to investigate. I think finally, I think we mentioned it earlier, I think the issue of unleashing the power of the consumer. I do think there's quite a lot of mileage we can make with things like green steel definitions, trying to say to people, here is a product which if you buy, there is a promise that that is truly green, for really relatively minimal costs. But we have to pull a whole very wide array of policy levers.
Emma, you were just nodding vigorously, but I wanted to ask you about this political economy and adaptation as well, and whom you protect, whom you don't protect, those sorts of questions. How is the political economy of resilience? Does that help or hinder the political economy of emissions?
I think there's some very challenging discussions that different parts of the world will need to have in terms of the resilience agenda, and some countries have got further than others in terms of having that discussion from a political perspective. All of this takes time, none of this is easy, and you need to do it in a way that brings in local communities as well. And I think one of the things we're all struggling with is getting the right narrative to have this discussion so that it spreads beyond whether it's the where the political discussions have to everywhere in an economy and in a country. So I think that is something that we still haven't got right. But over time, we do need to create the space for politicians to be brave in terms of some of the challenges that will need to be made around some of the issues that we've touched on, be it flooding, water shortages. And all of this will require leadership, and leadership from all sectors. So the public sector, the private sector, investors, moving into that space of really understanding the challenges that we need to discuss.
Okay, yeah, I have lots more questions, but I think you want to open it to the public. I have one more round, which you can answer either in one number or in two numbers or two sentences. I just want to know from each of you, how long do you think it will take in the UK until everybody has an electric car, until the majority of people stop eating red meat? I just need two numbers, and if you want to give a sentence of explanation, you may. Nobody's coming forward to start.
I'm going to answer the question you should have asked. A carbon price doesn't redesign a city. And we can build from the bottom up, as Adair described so brilliantly tonight. And please read the work of the Energy Transition Commission. I'm a member of it, but it's Adair that's leading the charge with the wonderful Ajay Mathur from India. Carbon price doesn't redesign a city. 20, 30 years down the road, the 70% of or so of emissions and output that comes from cities will be much higher than that. This is a city story. It's a story about how cities function. Now, the land uses are fundamental importance too, don't get me wrong, but the big numbers are in the cities. And we have to find ways of designing cities that function much better. You don't get at that from a sectoral bottom-up story. And we have to think what kind of policies we're going to bring to bear. That will partly be design, it will partly be regulation, it will partly be standards. We start saying where cars can go, how you put these modern systems of transport and car sharing together. That will be a huge part of the story. And it's that kind of reconstruction and doing things very differently that the narrow trade-off story often miss. Don't get me wrong, you have to make hard choices and you have to do difficult politics. But the narrow sector-by-sector trade-off is only part of the story. Neglect it at your peril, but you have to see the big picture of particularly city design and how we function in cities and the transport and the buildings and the heating and so on. And to do that, you're going to need much more than a carbon price. I've been out in front on a carbon price, I stay out in front on a carbon price, but I've never said it's the whole story or it's the simple one-shot solution. It absolutely isn't, but it's essential to the story.
Sam, you said at the beginning that you wanted some sort of ideas of research for the future.
It's interesting and how you avoid my question.
I'm going to answer it.
Let's do her avoidance strategy.
I'll do my avoidance strategy. Nick has focused on some of the things, but it seems very clear that what we need to do is to do much more work on how we communicate to the public, how we make behavioural changes. We also need to do a lot more work on the different governance structures, because you were talking about me looking at the totality of the problem, and being a geographer, I think one tends to do that, and look at the interlinkages, and we don't have governance structures that by and large do that. There have been a lot of attempts to do it, but again, they are not very successful because of sectorial interests are very, very entrenched. And we have to, I think, work out ways that give us the best sort of incentive structures for change, the best governance structures for change.
Adair's going to answer the question. Who knows what Emma will say afterwards.
By 2030, 90% of the new sales of cars in the UK will be electric vehicles, whether battery or fuel cell. But clearly in stock terms, that will then take till 2040 or 45 before 90% of the stock is EV or fuel cell. I suspect we'll never get to 100% because there'll be antique cars, there'll be somebody who's still keeping a car that they run all the time, but that gives you an idea of the place. And for red meat, I think what we're probably going to see, first of all, I think we will probably see synthetic meat equivalents coming into things like hamburgers and even steaks, and I think that will occur within the next 10 years and will be significant. And I think what you'll probably see is an increasing number of people with a somewhat less meat intake and with treating, you know, a full non-synthetic steak as something that they have, you know, not once a week, but once every 3 weeks as a speciality, etc. But I think it'll take a hell of a long time before we persuade people to completely to eliminate it. But I think the trend will be away from natural red meat at a reasonable pace.
I like people asking questions.
And how it... Yeah. We're supposed to be trying to identify the big things. It's true that the meat consumption is a big thing, but I would prefer to approach it in the way that Adair described. It's not stopwatch, get from here to here. It's how you can adjust and how and why people's habits change, both on the consumption side and on the production side. And there's lots we can do on the production side that can make a very big difference. You know, like not feeding the beef on soy that has come from cutting down forests. So I much prefer to go to look at the production side, look at the consumption side, how fast can we adjust, rather than just knock it down to when will that person stop eating red meat.
So Sam, I want to, you've already mentioned the Transition Pathway Initiative, and I can see Simon Dietz in the audience and other people who are part of this initiative. It came out of two groups of pension funds, the Environment Agency Pension Fund and the Church's Investment Fund. So between us, we're probably, I don't know, 13, 15 billion. It is now providing a framework for 31 trillion assets under management. We're using that framework to understand how different sectors are transitioning to a low-carbon economy. And I call it out because it's a fantastic initiative between asset owners, pension funds, asset managers, academic institutions. We've got FTSE Russell involved as an index provider. And it's about collaboration and serious analytical data. We need to move it beyond low-carbon transition to really talk about the things that I mentioned, the whole resilience and adaptation agenda. But this is where small groups of people can lead to much more significant initiatives. And those are the sorts of things we need to seed and grow, and where institutions like the London School of Economics can really help drive that analysis for the future. And we need to speed it up, this area of collaboration between the public, the private, and the third sector.
Good. Thanks for saying that. I'm really glad you did. I don't know how much Simon paid you for it, but it was really good. Let's open it to questions, and I suggest I'm not going to get to all of you. I suggest I collect three at a time, if you're happy with that. Let me start somewhere in that corner. There's a roving microphone, I assume, somewhere. Two ladies over there, let's collect those two in the middle there, exactly there. Please identify yourself. Please keep your questions short. You know,
I'm Lucinda Byrne. I just finished a Master's in Economics, and I'm just quite interested in the subject. Do you feel like there's a sort of philosophical inconsistency between economics, modern economics, mainstream economics, and the kind of environmental economics and the constraints we're putting on businesses, not purely acting in terms of their own monetary self-interest, and also philosophically in terms of expecting agents to sort of generate kind of progress rather than actually we have a sort of top-down agenda and maybe the government needs to be slightly more forceful in terms of structuring society. What are your thoughts on that? And I guess to address the political question directly,
No, that's all right, don't worry. One question is a good number. Why don't you go just straight behind you?
Hi, my name is Sadie, and I'm also a student. And I see a lot of young people in the room, and my question is, for young people who care about climate change, where should they put their energy? Because I think it's pretty overwhelming to choose. What should I prioritize?
Okay, let's, where could we go next? Come to the front row. People in the front row. Please.
I'm David, I'm from Birkbeck, and I'm doing history and international relations. I've taken a note down, and I just remembered the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century. And the lesson from what I've taken from that is how ordinary people reacted to the exploitation that came from the use of coal and then oil. Why hasn't the Grantham Institute tackle this situation democratically instead of just imagining that rule by authority works, when in actual fact historically it has never worked, and we've seen what the results have become, for instance the First World War and the Second World War?
Okay, I'm not answering questions because I'm on the panel, but I would shall we who wants to go first? So we have the sort of philosophy of economics, what should young people do, just transition, and economic history. Nick, you seem...
I'll try. I think economics is getting a bit better around how to model and understand, analyse these kinds of issues. I mean, the standard economic description of an agent is an all-knowing, perfectly informed, immediately calculating individual who acts narrowly in his or her own interests. That's the model you put up the first year economics or even A-level economics. And operating in markets which function perfectly. Now, I've obviously set it up in a way that we wouldn't want you to take it too seriously. It's a starting point for some things. But now I think we understand much better the multiple market failures at work here. I usually offer six, and they're a basis of policy. I mean, the greenhouse gas emissions, the R&D, the networks, the lots of networks here, the information stories, and all the other things that come with it, like pollution from burning fossil fuels. You have to tackle all those things along with the capital markets imperfections as well. So I do think that our subject is getting better at tackling in a sort of direct analytical way the issues that arise here. I also hope we're getting better at thinking of models of behaviour where people want to behave responsibly. I think most people in the room wouldn't want to buy a carpet that they knew was made from child labour, even if it were cheaper. And that comes from appealing to people to have some kind of understanding of the circumstances of other people, and of course the knowledge that it was made with child labour. If you think of how people's attitudes have changed towards plastics, it's happened amazingly quickly. And it's not simply that somebody has whacked them with a price, it's actually the information and the understanding. So I think our subjects have been getting better. I think there are strongly positive things about behaviour which can be activated by people, not necessarily by governments, by people in ways that can be very productive. So I do think that economics is much better than it used to be, and I think it's nowhere near good enough on these subjects, but some of us are trying to move it in a much better direction. Young people, well, you have to hold... There are a number of things you can do, right? One is study and be good at it. Just being sort of nice and cuddly and well-motivated is good, but it's not good enough. I mean, you've got to be essentially skillful, analytical, informed, and bring and marshal good arguments so you can train. You can hold politicians' feet to the fire, and if you ask politicians in the UK or anywhere else, what's in their in tray? What emails do they get? What letters do they get? What do people bring up at their MP's surgery? It's not very much climate change. And that's something which you can do, so that they know that this is important. They might know, but they know that you think it's important. I think that's very valuable. I do think that church move. I'm not religious at all, and my father would never have believed that I would say this, but I'm a big fan of the Pope. And he has captured and expressed himself in very strong ways, and many other religious leaders too, let it be said. So I think being part of the pressuring and arguing, both in analytically informed and in thinking through the ethics of it all, I think that's extremely important. So demand leadership and offer leadership, but do it in a well-informed, skilled way. The last question about democracy. I think what we've seen policy on climate change arise in democratic ways. We've seen policy on climate change arise in undemocratic ways. But if you think of plastics, just to take a recent example, there was enormous public outcry when, you know, David Attenborough showed the dead baby whale, and you know, you saw the kind of devastation in the oceans. That was very powerful communication, which sparked people who then put pressure on politicians to act. You can also look at China, which is a different kind of political structure, and China's emissions of CO2 look to be plateauing about now. There'll be bumps and ups and downs, that's why it's a plateau, not yet a big decrease. And that was a very strong political change, which arose in large measure because of the political pressure from very polluted cities, the political worries about water and climate change. So politics works in different ways in different places. I don't think you need to look to autocracy or democracy. I think both can deliver on this. If you ask me what I like, it's democracy, but for but broader reasons than delivering in this particular way.
And perhaps we should...
Emma and Judith, quickly, and then we get another round.
I wanted to give a regulatory perspective, and we need to make sure that when we're thinking about these things, we're joining up different parts of regulation. So there is no doubt in my mind that when we got the financial regulators interested in climate change and environmental sustainability, it's driven the agenda into different parts of the economy, and that's been hugely important. And on what should young people do, I think it's about action and taking action. In any of your careers, you can bring environmental analysis, climate risk analysis into what you're doing so that it just becomes core to the decision making of businesses and organisations. So I don't think you necessarily need to target any particular sector. I think there's going to be some fantastically interesting and innovative work to do in this space. But you could be doing work around climate risk as an accountant, as well as an entrepreneur and in the innovation sector. So just applying and getting on and doing things.
Very good.
I was just going to make two rather small points. The first is that you said Grantham Institute was doing it in a top-down way. Well, of course, we've done a lot of work in Africa with a lot of stakeholders. So we certainly, all our work hasn't been that way. And there's a project, an ongoing project now, looking at the equity questions and how to make the transition or sets of transitions in a just and equitable way. And that's a transition not only to a low-carbon economy, but a transition on the adaptation and the resilience side. So there is work there, but it takes some time. On the young question, if you're a student here, it's one of the sort of ambitions that we have is to try and embed sustainability questions in the teaching of every department. So what you could do if you're not doing anything on this side is to ask your department, why not?
Very good. Let's get another set. Let's go a bit further back. All the way in the back in the middle, I see lots of hands. Select some of that crop of hands over there, maybe. I don't know what the collective noun of a hand is, but Yeah, somewhere in the middle, just stand the mic in, that's very good.
Thank you. My name's Ed. I'm a former politics and international relations student, now working in the dark world of public relations, so sorry about that. I've got a very quick question for Lord Turner and then a very quick question for Emma Boyd. Firstly, for Lord Turner, you mentioned the report on the 20th of November. Out of the sectors you mentioned, will animal agriculture be your focus? If not, why not? Secondly, for Emma, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being extremely satisfied and 1 being completely dissatisfied, where would you be when it comes to the level of media attention and coverage for the environment, climate change in general? If it's below 5, it would be really interesting to know what sort of your thoughts are and how that could improve, because I just think public awareness, whilst it is improving, it's still, you know, in terms of media coverage.
Very good. Let's just go one row back. The lady just behind you.
Hi, thanks for your amazing lecture and panel. My question is addressed to Emma. I'm the entrepreneur in the water innovation sector, and I find it very, very difficult to get through politics through within the public and private sector, because it's a natural monopoly in the country, even within the opening the market. And there are a number of water innovation platforms here in the UK. It's Water Stewardship, and there are Water Fund, Water Hubs, and others. So question here is, you were talking about resilience and collaboration. How do we actually implement that? Where is to start? Because there's a lot of cosmetic exercise going on, and there are a lot of summits where sustainability innovation are on the top panel, but when it comes down from the CEO levels and executive management to the procurement, this is where a lot of difficulties start. How to overcome those? Thank you.
Good, very good. Where could we go next? Top left. So I have so much choice. It's very difficult to choose, but we do it by spatial allocation. Yeah. Just the top left, please. Yeah.
My name is Dominic Steams. I'm a retired doctor. I have seen landmine injuries. I can't see any progress towards environmental goals without a great spread of equality. And I would ask, how on earth can war be avoided so that it doesn't destroy all progress?
Okay, there's a couple of questions. That last one might take a bit longer. A couple of questions for Emma and Adair, and maybe then open it up, see how we're doing on time. Yep. Emma and then Adair.
So the first question was about media, and I think it's patchy. There are times when it is absolutely the headlines, and I can think of this summer, particularly around prolonged dry weather / drought. If you take Nick's point about the Blue Planet 2, if you analyse the amount of time that was given to the issues of plastic, it was 3.5% of the overall documentary. Mm. And yet that 3.5% delivered extraordinary change and momentum around the plastics agenda. So I think it varies, and we need to make sure there is a common thread around environmental issues throughout our media. So I think it's very interesting that the BBC has decided to put climate change much more on its in its programming, and really wanting to focus it, admitting that they have got the balance wrong in the past, and they want to correct that. So I think it's also really important that we tell the positive stories of environmental sustainability too, and that is quite challenging to do. Not everybody wants to tell the positive stories of this agenda. On the water technologies, I think there's no doubt that other countries are probably working far more together as a sector across the public, private and innovation than we are right now here in the UK, and it's something that we probably should recognise more and do more of. A colleague of mine was out in Tokyo recently where there was a water congress taking place, and I think whilst there was definitely British representation there, they were not there as a coherent sort of, you know, with the water industry together. So that is something that I think we could apply a bit more attention to within this country, and is perhaps something we should be prioritising more, and is the sort of conversation that I'm having across the public-private sectors to what we can do about it.
Well, on the first question, are we covering agriculture? We are not covering agriculture in this report for the simple reason that we can't cover everything. And it's more important for us to focus on something and add value on that. We can turn to agriculture later. In our initial year, we focused very heavily on the power system. We then decided to focus on this cluster of large heavy industries and transport sectors where we think we can develop a vision. I think if you're going to address agriculture, you do have to look at it in the round. You have to look at agriculture and you have to look at land use and the balance between agriculture and biodiversity and forests as natural sinks. So it's a hell of a big issue in itself. So we may come to that in future. The ETC will you know, roll on as long as we think we can do useful things. But we really haven't done that yet, perhaps except in one or two places where we have noted the importance of end-of-life emissions in fertilisers as well as emissions in the production of fertilisers. If you make an end fertiliser on a urea basis, even if you produce that in a completely zero-carbon fashion, you are still putting into the ground something which will naturally release both CO2 and in some cases also nitrous oxide, which is a very powerful greenhouse gas. So we have noted it where it naturally arises out of our existing work, but no, sorry, we haven't dealt with that yet. And I have to say we also do not have an answer to world peace. So I'm afraid I can't help on that. But all I will say is, you know, if we do not deal with climate change, and particularly, as Nick says, if we allow it not just to go to 2 degrees but to 3 degrees, we are going to produce really catastrophic changes and migration effects and desertification effects, one of the consequences of which will be increased civil strife. I mean, I think, you know, there really is a sort of trade-off here. I mean, it would be great if we could limit it to 1.5 degrees centigrade, though I'm going to be blunt, I think that is now almost impossible. I think it's really important that we prevent it going above 2 or at least appreciably above 2. I think once you get to 3 and 4, we've really created an absolute disaster. One of the things we did back on the Climate Change Committee originally was say one of our guidance things of what the target should be was that you should be trying to get a set of emissions where the chances of it going to 3 or 4 degrees were way down at 1% or less than 1%, as it were, excluding that tail of the really catastrophic change is almost more important than whether we end up at 1.5 or 1.6 or 2.1. Somewhere above 2, we start getting into very scary territory indeed.
Okay, I'm not quite sure how we've done that. We started off very bullish about net zero and we end up with a sort of slightly scary vote, but that's how the discussion is going. Let me close it here by thanking Emma, Nick, Judith, Adair. You've been fantastic. You've given us a good anniversary panel discussion. Thank you very much indeed.